there's moonbeams in your elbows, and there's rivers in your head. And I wanna see you forever, babe, forever. Don't take me back in time now, but there's nothing for me there. Welcome to On the Wing Podcast, fueled by Purina Pro Plan and Trampled by Turtles, taking us into a new episode. Thanks again to the band Trampled and Dave Simonette for letting us use his new tune, or their new tune, Forever. Very appropriate, very fitting. Coming at you today with the snow falling down in the Great Lakes State, in my home state of Michigan. I'm here in Michigan for the Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever annual Michigan State meeting in mid-January, and I'm joined by a fellow Red Wings fan, a fellow Tigers fan, and a fellow very disappointed Detroit Lions fan, Suzanne. I was so worried about mispronouncing your last name, I screwed up your first name. Suzanne Englevich.
Good enough.
Suzanne Englevich. How many people butcher your last name?
Well, the proper Polish pronunciation is indeed Englevich, but throughout the years, seeing the fear in people's eyes when they see the W, the C, and the Z, and not enough vowels, I am used to all of the renditions and will accept them all. So it's Englevich.
Englevich. Yep. Okay. Well, thank you for taking time to join me, Suzanne.
Great to be here.
How disappointed are you in the Detroit Lions?
This has been painful. I attended some Detroit Lions games this year, a lot of hope. Didn't see that coming with the Commanders. Did not see that coming. It's been tough, but I will rebound quickly with a really good Red Wings season, and I'm just going to focus ahead, so I'm not looking back.
So. And you are a partial season ticket holder.
Yeah. For Detroit Red Wings. Yeah. So I have a friend who is, and so I have a chance to do mini packages, so I get to do some tickets with them. So lucky me.
And a Tigers fan.
Huge Tigers fan. Yes. My whole life.
We share a lot in common.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, as a native Michigander, yes, yeah. Absolutely. So,
and we joined a whole bunch of other fellow employees last mm-hmm. night at the Red Wings game where they won. They beat the Montreal Canadiens, and they won is hopefully a trend because they got a new coach here that things seem to be turning around.
Yeah, they look good. They look good. It was a good game last night. It's always, I think, a little sweeter to win an original six game, you know, to see mm-hmm. that game. So it was a good game. It was fun to hang out with the Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever crew and enjoy a Red Wings win.
The other thing we talked about that we have in common over just the course of the last month is we both shot Cosmic Clays for the first time ever. Explain Cosmic Clays for the listener that has no idea what we're talking about.
It is a wild experience to shoot in the dark with neon lighted clays. We had gone out. I went out with my friend. You know, you go out at like 9 o'clock at night in pitch black, and it was 5-stand and heated. It's been so cold here in Michigan. And you're just busting these cosmic-looking neon clays that explode into neon colors. And it's really a lot of fun. It's difficult.
Yeah.
But it's kind of a rocking experience, too, where they've got music going. And it's just a really fun atmosphere. And it was the first time I'd done cosmic clays. I'd seen it. And we had a really good time. It was a lot of fun.
We have a new advertisement from a long-time partner of ours, Minnesota Horse and Hunt Club, which I know you're familiar with.
I've been out there, yeah.
Their new ad in the Pheasants Forever Journal is promoting cosmic clays through the winter. And when my team saw that ad, they're like, well, that's where we got to go for our Christmas party. So our department Christmas gathering was at the Horse and Hunt Club, Horse and Hunt Club. And same thing, a heated 5-stand building with black lights and neon clays.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we didn't have the music. You know, we talked about this. I was thinking everything was perfect except we needed the Bee Gees in the background. Yeah. There was no Bee Gees.
Yeah.
But it was fabulous. It was so much fun, and we just took turns you know, five stand with five stations, and we just rotated and just had an absolute blast. If folks have done cosmic bowling, right? It's the same thing with a shotgun.
Yeah, absolutely. It's it's really, really fun. We had Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin blaring the whole time. You couldn't really focus on what you're normally shooting, normal shooting circumstances, but it was definitely worth it. So,
well, if listeners have never done cosmic clays before, find a local range that that offers that. I think that, I mean, it's not super common, but there's places around the country that have that.
Yeah, it's a regular thing. I think on standard Friday nights, a lot of the clubs do it every Friday night or every Wednesday night. So it's become pretty popular here, at least in the Michigan, in the Metro Detroit area as well. So.
Well, this is your Cosmic Clays episode of On the Wing podcast. So I butchered your first name. I muddled through your last name. We've talked a little bit about your Michigan roots. Tell us your biography. Tell us your story.
So I'm a native Michigander, born and raised. I did take a little sabbatical and lived in the Washington, D.C. area for about 14 years, but very happy to be back in Michigan. Grew up in the Metro Detroit area. I'm from Rochester Hills. But I kind of absconded at around 18, headed up here. This is, we're actually in my stomping grounds of Michigan State University. So I went to, I lived up here for about 8 or 9 years undergrad at Michigan State and then law school. So I was up here for quite some time.
And we're in Lansing right now.
So this is a place I'm very familiar with for my, you know, academic life. But then after law school, I went straight to Washington, D.C. and spent, you know, again, about 14 years there. But
you lived in D.C.
Yeah,
for 14 years?
Yeah, that's where I was, and but had the opportunity to come back to Michigan. And I think the longer I was away from the state, the more I grew to appreciate my home state. And I thought, I can't wait to get back. And so now I'm back and making up for lost time and doing all the hunting and fishing and outdoor stuff. I bought, you know, a camper. I'm adventuring all over the state. So I'm just happy to be back here in Michigan post the DC time.
So, I haven't mentioned what you do for the organization yet, and people are starting to piece this together, that a law degree, 14 years in DC. So we're getting there, folks. You said you grew up hunting. You came back and you hunted. Did you grow up as a hunter?
Not at all. I think I have a little bit of an unconventional story. I think, especially in these circles, when you hear, you know, these long-standing stories of their hunting and their families, but I grew up in a family of no hunting, no fishing, no outdoor recreation. Nobody owned firearms. But I think what I was grateful is my parents, you know, raised me with this sense of curiosity and wonderment, and I got to travel a lot. And I think in traveling a lot, I really connected with the outdoors. And I think the minute I was mobile and had wheels, I was bothering my parents. I'm going up north to go camping, or we're going down to West Virginia to go whitewater rafting, or we're going to the mountains down in Tennessee. And they got real used to my gallivanting to the outdoors. They're still annoyed with all my gallivanting in the outdoors. They don't understand it, but they are so supportive. But it really was an inherent passion and connection to the outdoors. And in chasing those sunrises and sunsets, I started to really pay attention to the land around me, the opportunities. And I thought, I want to get on the water and fish, and I want to start hunting. So essentially,
it just came out of nowhere, or was there a person that led you to fishing or led you to hunting?
It was really, when I was a little girl, I used to get these opportunities to go down to Tennessee and play in the mountains and on the lakes. And I used to think that these mountains and these lakes, and also the northern parts of Michigan, I just thought, these are the most beautiful places on earth. And when I get old enough, this is where I want to live and be. And so I think just my curiosity and wonderment with those spaces led me to this natural curiosity about hunting and fishing, because you're surrounded by it. But I think because I didn't have a support or structure system, I've had to teach myself every skill I have when it comes to hunting or fishing or outdoors. And I've also been so grateful to come across organizations like Pheasants Forever and other organizations where every opportunity I came across to learn something, I took it. And that's what I've done. I've just kind of a self-taught, you know, I don't have the story about the grandpa or the brother or the dad or the husband that drags you out. In fact, I usually end up dragging the guys out to go hunting and fishing. So it's really, I am truly kind of the adult onset, you know, hunter, the, you know, just taught myself, but relied very heavily on just incredible opportunities that would come up through organizations like similarly ones to Pheasants Forever. And it's just cultivated that in me and made me more passionate. So now, you know, at this point over the past, you know, decade or so, I've had some pretty incredible hunting and fishing trips in my life.
Yeah. So. I mean, that's fascinating because like you articulated, everybody expects sort of the, you know, the uncle or the aunt or, you know, grandpa or boyfriend or whatever, right? Like there was some mentor. It sounds like you were just bound and determined along with organization's help to embrace something that you were curious about and just went after it.
Yeah.
Very unique, like, case study in yourself. Like, do you, in part of, you know, what you've embraced here and going joining the organization is you've met lots of other people that are like you as adult onset hunters, but are they like you in the same way that they've kind of joined through events and taken on hunting on their own? Or are you an anomaly in your own estimation?
You know, I will say it has been a little bit of a challenge to meet people similarly situated as me. I mean, they certainly have the interest and it probably came from, you know, a partner or a spouse that's like, oh, I'd like you to join me and do it. But me, it's a little bit more just an internal ambition to want to do it. And, you know, especially with Pheasants Forever, I had the opportunity, someone invited me to a grouse camp in northern Wisconsin. And I went up there and had the absolute time of my life. And then I became very curious about, from there, from grouse, pheasant. And it just so happened that Pheasants Forever was hosting a women's learn to hunt. And I thought, well, I know how to wing shoot.
Yeah.
But I want to learn more about pheasant. And it was so great because it inspired, I think, my interest more in habitat, which I didn't expect to be part of that. And so those are the but I met some amazing people at that event and then joined back then, you know.
Was this an event in Michigan?
It was, yeah. Okay. This was years and years ago. But that was just a great catalyst for me to get even more involved on, again, with habitat and conservation because I didn't join with the intent of learning more about that. I wanted to learn about pheasants and how to shoot them and where to shoot them and get myself out to South Dakota at some point, you know. But along the way, I met some really incredible people that, you know, opened up different doors to the outdoors in a way I wasn't really anticipating. So
that's fabulous.
It was great. Yeah. It's been a fun ride. I've had some great hunts and, you know, I'm primarily a deer and duck hunter, but, you know, I've had opportunities out, you know, Wyoming to antelope and mule deer and, you know, gone, done, you know, just done some great hunts that, you know, again, the opportunities there, I'll never say no. So
somebody's listening right now and they're thinking, you know, I don't have a friend or significant other, but I'm curious, like Suzanne, any bit of advice you would offer a listener that is similar to you, that has some confidence but just doesn't know where to start?
There's a lot of resources out there, and I would just say take advantage of every opportunity to learn, whether that's a podcast, listening to it, whether it's watching YouTube videos, whether that's going to meetings, you know, for organizations, joining your local chapters. I would just say don't turn down the opportunity, even if you feel nervous or intimidated by the opportunity because you haven't done it before. Take up the opportunity because I think the folks in the outdoor world and the hunting and fishing world are some of the most generous stewards when it comes to teaching about whether it's just firearms, hunting, any of that. If take advantage of that kindness and their willingness to teach you because they really are some of the most generous stewards when it comes to their time, when it comes to, you know, again, outdoor recreation. Yeah.
That's very, I didn't know that element of the story. I didn't know we were going to go here.
Yeah,
that's very cool.
That's my story.
So to swing back to your story, you talked about a law degree from Michigan State and spending 14 years in Washington, D.C. So tell us a little bit about your career up to this point.
So I've always been a student of history. And so that was my motivation to want to study, you know, I have such a nerdy background, but not in a fun wildlife biologist way. But I studied political theory and constitutional democracy was my undergrad degree. But I've
political theory, yes. And constitutional democracy. Okay. That is what did you think you were going to do for a career?
I always had an interest in serving the cause of freedom and just being involved with, I just kind of continuing this amazing notion that we have in our country about our constitution and our rights and our heritage and all things Americana. So I always enjoyed that very much. And so didn't quite know specifically what area I wanted to go into, but I studied political theory. But I think when you have a degree like that, you don't really have much of a choice but to go to law school. Like, what do you do with that? So from there, I went to law school. And I, at the time, though, I had a lot of opportunities, you know, the proximity to the Capitol here, mm-hmm. you know, Michigan State's proximity to Lansing. I had internships and the ability to, you know, work and learn more about how government works and how policy works. And so I had a front row seat to that here in Michigan. So I was really grateful for those opportunities. And that kind of fueled me more into the advocacy side. So when I went to law school, it wasn't with the notion to be a litigator. It was to truly, you know, amplify the voice about advocacy on issues that I thought were important, you know. And so that's kind of how it started. And then after law school, I went straight to D.C. and had an incredible opportunity to clerk for an attorney that had done some just incredible work, even in front of the Supreme Court. And so it really inspired me to get more involved in that. And next thing I knew, I wasn't sure where I was going to end up, but I had an opportunity with the National Rifle Association. And that's where I had worked for the last, all of my time in DC was with the NRA. And, you know, that was such an incredible opportunity to interface with so many different communities, and including the sportsman's community. You know, I found myself traveling all over the country talking from a grassroots perspective. Mm-hmm. Going to sportsmen's clubs all over the country. We were just talking about Wilmer and, you know, Minnesota. In Minnesota, but yeah. I mean, all over the country, I had this great opportunity to go to sportsmen's clubs and talk to people about the important issues to them, not just the gun issues, but in those conversations, they would talk about their concerns about, you know, the legacy of hunting mm-hmm. and what are we going to do and their conservation issues that were specific to their states. And so I had this great opportunity, you know, post-academic career to jump right into advocacy. And I was so fortunate that with NRA, I was exposed to so many different communities within that. And a lot of those included going to sportsmen's clubs, going to gun ranges, going to, you know, different places all over the country and listening to their stories. And they all had, you know, a nexus, of course, to firearms, but a lot of it was talking about, you know, hunting, conservation, wildlife, and those types of things. And so that became kind of a spoke in my passion, you know, where it lined up with what I personally was excited about in my own life. But then I saw this opportunity to really, you know, maximize, I guess, my experience, you know, as far as working in a policy side that I thought was really, really important. So
you threw your name in the hat. For a job posting, and the job posting was the organization Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever's first ever, 41 years in at that point, right?
Yeah.
State level advocacy manager, right?
Yes.
So in charge of what's going on at the state capitals, as opposed to, you know, whether it's Dave Nompson, Jim Inglis, Bethany Erm, or now Ariel Wiegard, Andrew Schmidt, the folks that have always been on our government affairs team, but they've helped on state advocacy, but they've been very, very focused on federal level, Farm Bill, Grasslands Act, NACA, things like that. And you're the first person that you are not focused on Washington, D.C. You are focused on Lansing, Michigan, and St. Paul, Minnesota, and we can test each other at state capitals, Dover, Delaware.
That sounds fun.
So tell us a little bit about what appealed to you that after a lengthy career with NRA, you threw your resume in for this first ever opening.
Well, it just seemed like an exciting opportunity for the organization. I think running in those circles, I knew that there was a high respect for the organization, but there was also this emerging demand for Pheasants Forever to be more involved at the states. I knew that before even seeing, you know, the opportunity, that I thought, well, this is an exciting thing to start for the organization. And I know they'd had some great, great people doing state stuff, but to dedicate an entire position to it. And it really fell in line with a lot with what I was doing on the state level. And I thought, well, this is an exciting new area that I think is emerging in a lot of different ways. And I could almost have the foresight to see all of the opportunities that Pheasants Forever could maximize their footprint without even having been hired. I could already envision all of the incredible places that they could grow at the state level, only because I had already known, you know, the high respect of the organization. But again, there was a demand that there's, you know, they want them to put their name on something or join with something, but they didn't have that state dedicated advocacy person. So I saw it as a great opportunity, and just so happened that it, you know, in the interview process and the discussions, that it kind of lined up that I was, what I was thinking and hoping for in the position were exactly what they were looking for. So it worked out great.
Well, that, it took me a long time to get here, but that's what our focus. I thought it was, you know, I thought it'd be interesting to kind of take a walk through your journey before people listened and automatically knew what you're doing on a day-to-day basis. And that's where the meat of the conversation is going to be. We're going to talk a little bit about what's on the horizon for 2025. And we got a couple of buckets of topics to talk about. Before we do that, I want to give a shout out to Purina Pro Plan, the title sponsor, presenting sponsor of On the Wing podcast, and national dog food sponsor of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. They are the best dog food out there. All of my pups, Esky, Gitchy, and Winter, all eat Purina Pro Plan, not just because Purina supports the wildlife habitat conservation mission of our organization, and that's definitely important to me, but they are the best. Purina Pro Plan is the best dog food out there for your working bird dogs. They have a team of the world's best scientists and nutritionists behind their dog food, and you can learn more at ProPlanSport.com. Purina Pro Plan, nutrition that performs. All right, so we're going to talk about state level advocacy and what's on your hit list, for lack of a better term, things that are have your focus. But before we talk about that, I want to put your Detroit Lions offensive and defensive coordinator hats on, because they don't have an offensive or defensive coordinator.
The pain keeps coming.
The Bears and the Jets have stolen our coordinators.
No.
But in the world of political affairs, what does it mean to be playing offense versus playing defense? And I bring this up on the front end because I think it's going to inform a lot of what we talk about the rest of the way here.
Sure. I think going into any legislative session, I think the first and foremost, whether it's offense or defense, you're trying to leverage the best, you know, setting your cause, your mission, and your organization up for success is the most important. And sometimes that means you're playing offense where you have these great ideas, or there's a necessity for conservation or habitat or access or hunting. Or in some cases, you're on the defense where some of those things that you've set up and taken time to do over the years are now being attacked or parceled out. And so you're on the defense. So one of the most important things, I think, with this organization and in this position is, you know, we are active in over 40 states. So it's a big lift. You know, I'm trying to get my feet out from under me as far as tracking everything in these states. But what that essentially is really important for this organization from the advocacy standpoint is to be prepared to either advance the cause through an offensive measure or defend it. And that's what we're already seeing. You know, the sessions are, most of them are all kicking off right now. And so we already know that there are places that we are going to play offense, where again, we're going to be propelling the mission, propelling issues that are going to help the organization, the mission, the cause. But the defense side is going to be a bit of a battle. And so you have to be very strategic. This is largely a bipartisan. Conservation is largely bipartisan when it comes to, you know, the states, similarly, you know, to the federal side. But the reality is there's always going to be fights behind the scenes mm-hmm. on how to get there. So everyone agrees that we care about conservation. It's just, how do we get there? How do we do it? What are the mechanisms in place, you know, the funding and that sort of thing. So we have quite a few states where we're already kind of carrying over from last year where we were in the offense. And so we didn't quite, you know, get the finish line. So we're continuing the offensive efforts.
Before we start talking about this year, remind me how long you've been on with the organization. Cause it's been about a half a year now. Right?
Yeah. Seven months. Yeah. 7 months.
And as you look back to playing offense and defense in your first 7 months, mm-hmm. What stands out to you in the year 2024 where something that, you know, this was an example of offense that was a victory, or this was an example of defense?
As far as the victory goes, I'd point to Minnesota. They had a pretty incredible ballot initiative to fund their dedicated state, you know, funding mechanism. And that is something that, you know, they're reauthorized, you know, it's set in statute so many years. And this is a constitutional amendment that is up.
So you're talking about the Environmental Resources Trust Fund as opposed to not the dedicated legacy amendment funding.
Right.
So there's two different things
right.
in Minnesota. You're talking about the lottery.
The lottery funds, yep. Correct. And so that was something that we were able to get involved with the coalition early on to support that ballot initiative. And those always need, you know, support really as far as educating grassroots wise as to why this is needed, how it's used. Also, we have incredible staff in Minnesota that use that funding in Minnesota, and they can showcase how it's used.
And our chapters, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And so they have a lot of great opportunity to utilize that money. And so that was a ballot initiative that, you know, we got on board with. There's a wonderful coalition that worked together, and we had staff that was working hand in hand with them to make sure that that was supported, that we were able to kind of get that information out to our members, and it passed overwhelmingly, I believe 77%. So that was a big victory.
That's kind of a shocking number, isn't it?
It's a huge number. And so that is a pretty significant statement on what the people of Minnesota wanted. And that sets you up for success moving forward when mm-hmm. it's up for reauthorization again. So that was something that, you know, again, it's you're on the offense as far as propelling that forward. But, you know, it was one of those victories that we thought was fantastic.
And I use the word shocking, not in any sort of like that there was skepticism about it passing, but it's in the world we live in today with so much acrimony, when something passes at 3/4, and it was also one of those initiatives where if you didn't vote yes or no, it was counted as a no vote.
Yeah.
So the fact that over 77%, think about that. Like 77% of the voters, you know, a lot of times you can read this ballot and it's like, I don't even know, right? And if you didn't vote on it, it's going to be counted as a no. 77% took the time to check yes. Mm-hmm. I want these funds going to the outdoors. Mm-hmm. That does speak to the bipartisan nature mm-hmm. of the environment and conservation and wildlife habitat.
Yeah. No, it really does. And we had to be very specific in our communication about the, you know, we can talk a little bit about ballot initiatives. They're pretty fascinating. But that was a great, I say we're on the offense there because we really, you know, we took it upon ourselves to get out there and educate folks. Mm. But there's other efforts that you would see more as an offensive sort of measure as far as, you know, the right to hunt and fish in Florida. You know, that was something that after years of discussions and talking that you go ahead and you put together the effort and you run it through all the traps that are required by the state. And that was a true success as well. So you get these bills specifically that you really are on the offense where it really comes down to you creating that effort from grassroots, you know, and up. And so that was another one, you know, that was a success as well. So
beyond Minnesota, another state that I want to highlight in terms of things that that happened positively, or at least positive momentum last year, is Kansas. Tell me about what happened in Kansas and where we're going.
So Kansas is a unique story. They're one of only 15 states that does not have any type of state-based conservation funding.
One of 15 only.
Yeah. Hmm. And so you can imagine that there's a pretty incredible need in that state to, you know, just outdoor recreation, water, land. You know, there's so many different areas that it would benefit. And there is a fantastic coalition there called the Kansans for Conservation, of which Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever have been part of for quite some time.
Kansans for Conservation.
Yeah.
For folks keeping track of acronyms at home, that is KFC.
And we refer to each of our, they refer, it's wonderful, to buckets. So we have the buckets of different areas. And so some people get the bucket part. But so it's a fantastic coalition of over 40 different organizations that have come together to really propel this. And they had introduced a bill last year, and it was kind of their first shot at it. Didn't quite make it, you know, through the session, but really excited that they've just now in the last week or two have introduced the bill for this year. It'll be getting a hearing pretty soon here, but we've been really, you know, just so involved with that. We've got, you know, some staff folks will be at the Capitol doing, you know, a lot of work there, talking to lawmakers. Mm-hmm. There'll be a Capitol Day in February. So really looking forward to being part of that initiative and seeing it to the finish line. Again, the momentum from last year, some lessons learned, and then capitalizing on that to really get it, you know, introduced in 2025, and the grassroots effort behind it is going to be, I think, really exciting for Kansans, but also those other states that don't have a state-based funding mechanism. I think it'll be something to model and watch is a very impressive effort. So
put on your historical political science degree, and think about, or you know, think about the idea that many times when legislation gets introduced in one year, it's pretty rare that it gets passed in the first year of introduction, right? Like, what most of the time, there's a 3 to 10 year run up for a lot of this stuff, isn't there? Or am I off in my time frame?
Well, it certainly depends on something large. Something large like this, you know, actually, and especially the amount of money, you know, sometimes that some of these require, but something large like this often requires a paradigm shift in thinking, you know, for not just lawmakers, but for people to understand it. So they've been at this for quite some time, and they've laid the groundwork over years to sort of get the outreach, the talking points, have discussions with lawmakers. And sometimes that's a difficult thing because lawmakers sort of come and go, powers change over time. So it does take something this big, can take a very long time to sort of shepherd through, you know, a legislative session. So this is a really exciting time because they were off to a great start last year, and again, lessons learned and refined. And I think it's going to be a good effort that it's all hands on deck.
Yeah, so. And you know, important thing that you mentioned that you know, a lot of times the clock doesn't start ticking with the first introduction. There's a lot of work that's done years, as you mentioned.
Right.
And similarly, with you know Minnesota's dedicated funding, which you know had a 10-year. Lifespan before it ever got introduced, and similarly here, leading up to the introduction of the bill last year in Kansas, you know, hopefully good things to come on that front this year.
Yeah, but it is certainly a prime example of being on the offense and trying to get a victory there. So,
all right. So as we planned for this conversation, you know, and figuring out exactly how to arrange the discussion, you built it around three buckets. Not KFC buckets, but three buckets. And those three buckets were state conservation funding, number one, hunting and access, number two, and the third bucket was nuanced, such a legal term, nuanced state issues. So three buckets. Let's run through them and what, you know, in terms of what's on your, you know, list of things that are coming up in 2025 as we work our way through these three buckets. So number one, state conservation funding. So what's on your mind What states are on your mind as we work through this one?
So I think one of the things about state conservation funding is it doesn't sound like an exciting topic, but it really is in many, many states, because as people who are hunters and, you know, using natural resources and outdoor recreation, you know, especially as hunters, though, in order to have abundant wildlife, you have to have habitat. In order to cultivate habitat, you often have to have public funding and, you know, sound conservation policy. And I always tell people that, you know, with the stroke of a pen, you know, conservation funding can be the start or the end, you know, for a lot of projects that we're working on. So as far as what we're working on right now is going through all of our states, again, this being a brand new position, mm-hmm. and not having the opportunity to go through and really identify what are all of the existing state-based funding sources that would, you know, provide opportunity for habitat improvement or wildlife management or access. So right now we're working on identifying what are those mechanisms in all 40 plus states that we have chapters and members and involvement in. So we're working on that because it's so important to not just identify them, but we want to maximize and utilize them most effectively as we can. And we have so many talented people in this organization that can do great work if they just have the funding to do it. So,
and know how to access the funding, right?
Right.
So in a sense, it's kind of like taking inventory state by state of, does this state have license plates that generate critical dollars for habitat? Yeah. Does this state have lottery funds that go to the environment? Is there dedicated funding of X, Y, or Z that gets directed towards habitat? Taking a full inventory and then figuring out exactly how to apply and turn those dollars into wildlife habitat. Is that accurate?
Yeah, no, absolutely it is. And so we're identifying them, but we're also in a position where we have to be very strategic about how to continue them, because that's where the fights come in is, you know, for example, there was a fund set up in Iowa, you know, many, many years ago through a ballot initiative. However, it's called IWIL. It has not been funded. There's no money in that fund. So that's a separate, you know, type of effort that we've already established a fund, but there's no funding in it.
Yeah.
Same thing we have where in Wisconsin, we have the Knowles Nelson Stewardship, which is a phenomenal and just critical part of funding that, you know, especially Pheasants Forever utilizes, and it's up for reauthorization, and that's not going to be easy. And so we have a lot of work to do. So identifying those funds, and then also knowing those nuances of what do they require? What does the budgeting or appropriations look like? Reauthorization looks like, and how does Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever help assist with that? There's a lot of incredible coalitions that do a lot of great work. And I think we're excited to be at this sort of forefront of how can we assist more than we have before. So that's a really important thing to just identify and then make sure that we're in the fight to make sure that we can protect those funds. I think one of the more critical, I guess, efforts that we have to be aware of and be keen to is diversion, where I think what happens in some states, and it's starting to emerge for me as I'm learning about all the emerging, you know, legislative issues state by state, is in some cases, you've got these pots of money or buckets of money that, you know, come in through maybe hunting fees and license fees. And unfortunately, that money sits there ready to be used for conservation projects. However, others in the legislature might think, well, we would like to use that money sitting there. We're going to use it for something else. So we have to be very keen to diversion tactics or redirection of funds that are meant for conservation efforts. And also it's just even more dangerous because it's a poison pill to any matching funds from the federal side.
Explain that.
So there's a lot of states with, well, for example, Pittman-Robertson and federal programs that sort of filter down from the federal to the states, and there are matching funds. For example, if you have a pot of money that, and again, every state is so different, but in general, you can say there's a state that has a pot of money that is solely fees that have been garnered from hunting license, fishing license, outdoor recreation, or stamps and that sort of thing. That money in some cases can be matched by the federal government, federal funds, mm-hmm. and that, you know, that way you're not leaving anything on the table, mm-hmm. you know, when you do that. And unfortunately, if you divert that money or redirect it to a different fund, it doesn't qualify for matching funds. So again, it really is a poison pill that we have to be keen to. And we've seen that happen, be proposed in a few states. And, you know, unfortunately, I think I've had this conversation at a couple capitals as I've been traveling, that we have less sportsmen, you know, and women serving in office in some states, and they maybe don't have the understanding of how the conservation side works with funding. And so they see that money and they want to redirect it to something else. And so we have to be very keen and aware of watching that. And that's why I think monitoring and tracking the state-based funding is so important in this position, so that we can have a collective voice. You know, again, there's so many great coalitions that work on this, but I think we have a unique voice to add to that, and we're kind of primed in a position to have a bigger voice now in those conversations. So
in your career, you know, prior to working for our organization, working for NRA, and so you've had a lot of interaction with elected officials. Have you noticed, you mentioned a moment ago about less and less hunters being involved as politicians. Is that noticeable to you?
It is. And I wondered if it was just me thinking that, but I've had conversations. In fact, I was at the Capitol in Wisconsin recently, and in a room with, you know, lawmakers, they said it first, is that we have less and less folks who are sportsmen or outdoor recreation type folks, hunters, that are running for office. And we need to collectively do a better job. And we've had some interesting conversations about how do we prompt that. We can do a lot of grassroots work to talk about the importance of these, especially in states with these funding mechanisms. But that is a separate conversation that I think
It's a lot of work to educate a new elected official on how hunting license dollars end up in the ground to protect water quality and create habitat and public spaces. That's a lot of education, right? And you don't get a huge amount of time and opportunity. So this is somewhat something of a call out to our listeners in Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever volunteers. Like, if you have a political bent to you and you care about these things, one way to get more engaged is to throw your hat in the political ring and get involved at the local, state, or federal level and run for office. That's a big ask in a lot of cases, right? But that's where you're heading, right?
It is. It has certainly crossed my mind in a lot of different ways about how do you create, you know, a program to inspire that in people and have those conversations to put that on their radar to think, maybe I could do this. I think it would serve the cause really well. And I just think there's a lot of great opportunity there. So I think it definitely warrants further conversations. It's certainly something I think about all the time, is how to get, you know, and that's not just, you know, people might be intimidated about, well, I'm not running for office, but we're talking at commission levels. We're talking at local, state levels as well. I mean, it's just, it'd be great to have more of the sportsman's community engaged in that political side.
Well, there's a little seed that we just planted for our listeners to think about. If you're hardcore conservationist, bird hunter, dog lover, maybe you should run for office. All right, the second topic bucket on your list was hunting and access. So what's on your mind here?
This is really a broad-ranging area, but in general, again, every state is so different when you take a step back and look at the availability of public versus private land. It's so different, especially when you look out west comparative to the South or the Midwest. So it's just recognizing what are the opportunities when it comes to opening up more access to hunting or outdoor recreation. What's really been fascinating for me in this position is learning about all the different programs that this organization has created to fit whatever need it is, whether it's focused on public or private, you know, lands. My role in that, though, is to take my cue from them that if there's a legislative component to it. In some cases, there are. Some cases, it's not. It's completely behind the scenes and working. But there's often legislation that comes up that in regards to landowners and if we're, or dealing with easements or dealing with contracts.
Or liability insurance and walk-in programs.
Absolutely. And so being able to review legislation in that regard, because I am certainly not an expert when it comes to how to set up the programs, but I think this shop, as far as government affairs go, can serve a really, you know, I think helpful service. And what would make this easier? Is it, you know, what are the regulations that we're dealing with? Are they up for consideration, review? Is there a piece of legislation where there might be unintended consequences, which often happens when, if it's poorly drafted legislation, are there unintended consequences that would have an effect on one of our programs that opens up or makes it easier to contract with landowners? So in that regard, it's not so programmatic. It's just making sure that any barriers are removed so that our folks out there who are experts in this can really, you know, use those programs effectively. So, you know, you see them come, you see these bills come down, and again, it's just, it's constantly reading bills and looking for things that, you know, again, would have an effect on that particular state and how they're situated. So
when I think about unintended consequences in bills, what comes to mind is, and I'm thinking you probably know about this one, and a couple of years ago there was a bill that essentially eliminated hunter education in schools, right? Can you talk about what happened that occurred and then how it got reversed?
So this has happened in quite a few states, actually. It's happened, and it was a funding mechanism. I think if we're talking about the same one, it was a funding mechanism. I've seen this in a couple of states where the money that was designated to do hunter education in schools was just removed. It was just, you know, a line through it. And when you look at legislative drafting, it's amazing how a comma or a period in the wrong place can have pretty wide ranging effects. And so, I've seen that happen in a couple of states where they have eliminated the funding for it in a different type of bill, or they didn't cross-reference the proper bill, and it eliminated entirely the source to be able to do those types of things. And so I have a background in legislative drafting as a research attorney. And so I know that there are cases that you have to watch very closely on how bills are, how laws are drafted, because if they're promulgated wrong, it could take you 5 years to undo it because it's not, oh, we made a mistake, let's go and just, you know, fix it. You have to start over. So it can get very finicky there when it comes to drafting, and again, unintended consequences there. But as far as, you know, hunting and access, you know, we're also a lot of monitoring as far as, you know, permits and fees and licensing changes. There's quite a few states that are kind of going through that time right now where they want to increase fees. And it's, you know, again, state by state, we have to look at state by state, but it takes a lot of conversation to get there, because people's initial reactions might be like, why, you know, I don't want to pay more. Why are we doing it? And so having the proper understanding about why the states are pursuing it, what does it look like, how does it affect our members in the community. So we're always monitoring a lot of changes in fees and you know, supporting agencies in states where we have partners and making sure that we're all on the same, you know, same page.
So one other thing you mentioned earlier, and I want to see if I lay out an analogy and tell me if it fits. So we got Ariel and Andrew working at the federal level, and part of the farm bill is VPA HIP, another one of my favorite acronyms, Voluntary Public Access Habitat Incentives Program, which creates funding to open up private land for public access. And states can tap into that funding and utilize it in, like in Kansas, WEHA, or in Iowa, IHAP, or WIA in Minnesota, PLOTS in North Dakota, take your favorite acronym, OLAP in Oklahoma, Open Fields and Waters in Nebraska. But there are some states that don't yet have some of those programs or want to kind of create something new. So we have our state coordinators working on things like that at the state level. We got our federal folks working on the federal funding. And then you're in the middle there at the intersection where you can kind of help facilitate things to make sure that when it gets put together at a state level, that we aren't leaving money on the table at the federal level that's going unused, but that it also doesn't have unintended consequences and it achieves the habitat and access deliverables that we're after. Is that an accurate assessment of how you fit into the kind of the flow chart?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. That's a really good way to sort of paint a picture of it. And also, I think just to add in there is, you know, one of the things is as we have a lot of folks who are incredibly talented in wildlife biology and agriculture, and that's their background, and they didn't pursue politics. But what I have found is when I do talk to lawmakers and I go into these capitals and I bring one of them with me, they are far more excited to talk to them than they are to me, because I can talk to them about policy and the drafting and shepherding the bill. But if I bring a wildlife biologist to the capitol to talk about projects in their backyard, in their district, how this works in their state, you kind of see them perk up. And they have a lot more questions for them than they do for me. And that's happened, you know, already.
Which is
so
wonderful,
far.
Right? Because they can see the vision of what we want to have happen on the ground.
Yeah.
For both the animals or the birds.
Right.
But then also for people, too.
Yeah. So that's another, I think, part of that picture is being able to connect the dots between the work that we do as an organization and the lawmakers, so they can actually see, you know, we invite them out to sites to visit. So we're doing that now, and that's been a really neat thing to witness, the connection between that side of the organization and the lawmakers, where maybe they never thought there would be that connection. And it's proved to be really helpful, and it's going to continue to. So
cool. All right. The third and final bucket on the conversation, part of the conversation, nuanced state issues. So what's on your mind here?
So I think, as I've said a few times, every state is so different. The political landscape, the political realities of bills, and what they're dealing with. And so what I'm sort of learning is there's a lot of different spokes to this wheel when it comes to whether conservation or access and habitat. But one example that is popping up a lot is charitable gaming or charitable fundraising legislation that I think some people think, well, what does that have to do with us? I think most of the folks probably know that one of the most successful models for the organization are fundraising dinners and those types of events. And what happens is, you know, a lot of the laws that exist right now are pretty antiquated in how they deal with charitable fundraising. Mm-hmm. And so that can cause a lot of issues in states, some states, for our organization and the chapters, because the permitting process, the licensing process, not being able to have online raffles or sell tickets online for raffles. And so there's this sort of call in quite a few states where they are introducing packages to sort of modernize the charitable gaming or charitable fundraising laws. And so that is something that we are getting involved with, because it's going to help streamline, you know, these opportunities to make our chapters, you know, want to make it easier for them to hold their events, and hopefully inspire them to do more. So,
yeah, you're right. Because, I mean, you can look online right now. We've got our 20th anniversary Quill Forever sweepstakes going on. It's online and it's going on right now. Mm-hmm. In the rules for online raffles versus sweepstakes in 50 different states is dramatically different, right? Like, we have all these things across the country that are these ability to gamble, to pay off stadiums, pay off different things.
Right.
And here we are as a charity, and we're handcuffed in so many different states to make the world a better place. Right. And it is, like, the word you used was antiquated. And I could not come up with a better word than that. There is a lot of antiquated laws out there that you pick your favorite charity, whether it's a church, the Kiwanis, or Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever, and our hands are tied. Like, if you look at our Quail Forever sweepstakes right now, there's a list of states of people in those states that can't buy tickets to support the cause, because the law won't allow it in those states. And it's like, come on.
Yeah, it can be very frustrating. I can only imagine for the chapters to have to navigate all of these things. And then you've got, you know, there's different, you know, requirements at the state level and the federal level. And when you're dealing with these things, you know, we're watching tax reform as well. I mean, that's a boring topic. But yeah, I mean, monitoring tax reform in some of these states to see how might that affect things either positively, you know, or negatively. So those are some of those nuanced ones. And we go back to, and I call them like the devils in the details with these bills, is I've had over the past couple of weeks, quite a few bills, you know, hit my inbox, and I'm getting, you know, many of them a day to read. And it'll say something like, you know, mule deer, you know, on it. And I think, what, you know, what is this? And then you read through it and you realize it's not really necessarily about mule deer. It's about, you know, codifying in statute hunting seasons, which would affect an upland season. And so there's certain things that you really have to, with a very keen eye, read through legislation, because, you know, the title of it, you think has nothing to do with habitat or access. But as you get into it, you realize this would have a significant impact on an upland season in this state. So looking at bills like that, I've had quite a few the past few weeks that have come across that you think, the title is not us. You know, we want to be mindful of our mission drift, right? But as you read through, so it really takes a lot of, you know, careful reading of a lot of these bills that we have out there. And again, it is, we're off to the races. We're talking hundreds of bills being introduced in a frenzy as they all start to kick off. And so just trying to keep up with all of them. And some of them, you know, are very interesting. We have, you know, a prescribed fire bill that I'm just looking through right now. And, you know, that's an important tool for the organization that some people might not know, in making sure you're going through that bill to say, is anything going to halt our ability to do this, or the liability side is significant as far as how they draft it. So looking at bills like that, you know, are always, it's always going to be out there, just so many different bills. And then just monitoring the possibilities. I think there's a lot of energy transitions going on right now, where there's a lot of consideration for solar and wind that is going to require large swaths of paths, you know, of land. And not saying, you know, you have to look at each of them differently. You can't say this is just a blanket one size fits all response to a bill. You have to read every single bill and understand every single effort, because it doesn't apply the same in every place. So there's a lot of nuanced stuff. And I think you had mentioned before about, you know, the different unconventional methods, you know, that we're looking at, as far as, you know, lottery funds or sports gambling taxes and those types of things. Those are very common, but they're so different state by state. So there's never a one size fits all approach to any topic. So it's a lot of digging deep on these bills.
Yeah, when you think about it from, like you say, energy, you know, whether it's wind or solar or oil and gas, license fees, hunting dates, funding mechanisms, and you think about, oh, we're active in 40 of the 50 states. And, you know, historically this has been kept an eye on through a state coordinator at the state level and through our federal folks. You know, you're in an extremely valuable position. As you go through, it's like, boy, how have we not had this position? You know, and you're probably sitting here, how come we don't have 14 of these positions, right? I mean, it's got to be overwhelming to an extent to be kind of the intersection now for all of these efforts happening in 40 different states.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's exciting. Thrilling, though. Right? Yeah, it's thrilling, because you start to see, you know, again, I said at the outset, the demand for Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever to join in on a lot of these efforts, because they want to hear what we have to say as an organization. They respect the organization and they respect the people that work in it and their expertise. And so being able to funnel that, you know, from working with the state coordinators, you know, and their willingness to work with me on the state government side has been great. And I've learned a lot from them, and I think they're learning about the process. And I think that's just going to create a really great foundation to grow the state advocacy side. And I think ultimately that's the goal. But I understand as of now, I'm one person in 42 states, but it's been really great so far.
All right. As we go to close, I'm going to have you think about, you know, what keeps you up at night, but then also what you see is the biggest opportunity. So as you think about that, I want to thank Onyx, proud supporter of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever, and thank Onyx for being a national sponsor of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever's wildlife habitat mission. If you've been living under a rock and you don't yet have an Onyx membership, go to the show notes. There's a link. That will take you to Onyx website, and you can enter in the code PFQF. You'll get 20% off your Onyx membership for the year, and Onyx will make a donation back to Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever's wildlife habitat mission. They're going to be a big player coming up at National Pheasant Fest and Quail Classic in Kansas City. They're sponsoring the Public Lands Pavilion. There's going to be a Friday night gathering. Stay tuned to pheasantfest.org. You can see all the stage lineups right now, everything going on at Pheasant Fest and Quail Classic, including what events still have tickets and what events are sold out. But you can check that out. And thanks to Onyx for supporting that event. All right, closing thoughts, Suzanne. What's on your mind as you tuck in to bed at night and you think about things that make you smile and things that make you restless? What's the yin and the yang?
Well, I think as far as what keeps me up at night, as far as negatives, I'm still thinking about how the Lions lost to the Commanders. I just can't get over it. I think from a perspective of the excitement of the potential and the opportunity keeps me up. It's the fear of missing out. I don't want to miss any opportunities to propel, you know, the collective voice of this organization and this cause. And with so much going on, I wake up in the middle of the night and think, oh, I have to respond about a Wyoming event or a Wyoming effort. And I wake up thinking about it, and then you're excited because you have ideas. And so it's a good thing. But I think that's, if anything keeps me up, I think it's just the fear of missing the opportunities, because they're growing and they're coming at us fast, and we really want to capitalize on all of them. So, but I think we'll be able to do that. And it's exciting. It's an exciting time.
So for folks that want to learn more, maybe they want to get engaged at the state level, is there a best practice for how they do that? Is that contact their regional representative and go through the state person, or do you want folks reaching out to you directly?
So, and that's something that I see as absolutely the biggest area that we can grow in, is plugging more people into advocacy on our end. I would say we have a dedicated email address. It's advocacy@pheasantsforever or advocacy@quailforever.org. And if you have suggestions or questions, or you see a bill that you think might be of interest, feel free to send that to us. Those are the things that we're reviewing. But I think the hope is, and that we're working on right now, is creating more opportunity for our members and our chapters. I think whenever you are a member organization, you have a responsibility to provide the tools, the resources, and the information to your membership about what's happening. And I think with the creation of this position, that's going to, you know, really motivate more people to get involved. And we want people to make their voice heard, get engaged at the political process, learn more about how bills are running in their state, and hopefully join us at some advocacy events. So I say reach out to us directly. We can have those conversations. And again, state by state, I appreciate their expertise and their knowledge in their own states. And we are going to do a lot more on the grassroots advocacy side. So.
Awesome. Well, sorry about the Lions. Go Wings.
Yes, go Wings.
Thank you for doing this. It is fabulous.
Well, thank you.
All right. For Suzanne Anglevich.
Yes.
Did I get it?
Yes. Very good.
I'm Bob St. Pierre, reminding you to always follow the dog. Something good will rise. Thanks for listening, folks.